For NPR Music, you're connected to All Songs Considered. I'm Bob Boylan. There are songwriters and then there are storytellers. And Steve Earle is certainly a teller of tales. His songs, The Devil's Right Hand, Copperhead Road, Guitar Town, they've been sung by artists like Johnny Cash, Emmylou Harris, Waylon Jennings, Vince Gill, Patti Loveless, and so many, many more. Steve Earle's inspiration came from two main storytellers, one Townes Van Zandt and the other Guy Clark. In 2009, Steve Earle made an album of Townes Van Zandt songs called Towns. And now he's paying tribute to his other hero, Guy Clark, by releasing Guy. The album by Steve Earle and the Dukes covers 16 songs by that great Nashville via Houston artist, Guy Clark. It leans towards some of his earlier tunes. On this edition of All Songs Considered, we premiere Dublin Blues, and I have a conversation, a great conversation, with Steve Earle about the day he left San Antonio, headed to Nashville to meet his hero, found him playing pool, and quickly became his bass player. We begin our conversation after listening together to some of Dublin Blues from that new record. I'm here in Washington, D.C., and Steve Earle, he's on a bus, his own tour bus, in Austin, Texas.
I was in Austin in the chilly parlor bar, drinking Mad Dog margaritas and not caring where you are. Here I sit in Dublin, just rolling cigarettes, holding back and choking back the shits with every breath. So forgive me all my anger, give me all my faults. Ain't no need to forgive me for thinking what I thought. I loved you from the get-go, I love you till I die. I love you on the spinning steps till you say goodbye. I'm just a poor boy, works my middle name. If money was a reason, then I would not be the same. I'll stand up and be counted, I'll face up to the truth. I'll walk away from trouble, but I can't walk away from me. Oh, give me all my anger, oh, give me all my faults. Ain't no need to forgive me, oh, playing what I thought. I love you from the get-go, I love you till I die. I love you on the spinning steps till you say goodbye.
So I think the first thing you have to do is explain to people when the first time you had a Mad Dog margarita and just what one is.
I don't think I ever had a Mad Dog margarita. I was never a margarita guy. When I drank tequila, I pretty much drank tequila. It was one of those deals. I bought lots of girls margaritas, but I never drank one myself.
And the Mad Dog one is like agave or something, right? It's not...
It's a thing at the Chili Parlor bar. The Texas Chili Parlor happens to be in the same building right next door to what was originally Rod Kennedy's Checkered Flag, which was the folk club in Austin in the 60s, the guy that founded the Kurgle Folk Festivals Club. And then that became Castle Creek at sort of the height of the Cosmic Cowboy thing in the 70s. I spent my 21st birthday playing bass for Guy Clark at Castle Creek at the last night of a six-night stand when Old Number One came out. And the Chili Parlor was always one of the first places Guy went when he got to Austin.
How did you ever become his... bass player? You knew his music, I assume, before you met him?
Well, I was 20. I knew about Guy because I left San Antonio, went to Houston, and, you know, Jerry Jeff Walker had recorded, you know, L.A. Freeway and that old-time feeling, and you know, and then eventually Desperado's Waiting for a Train. But even before that, when I got on my own, I went to Houston first, and I played a coffee house called Sand Mountain. And Guy had played there, Towns had played there. Jerry Jeff Walker wrote Mr. Bojangles in the apartment upstairs, which was Towns' apartment.
And just so people know,
I used to have to...
You're talking about Townes Van Zandt, because right? You know, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Keep
yeah.
Going.
I'm
That's
sorry.
Right. Keep going.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sorry. We all. Yeah. There's a reason why that my Towns tribute record is just called Towns, and this is just called Guy. But it's that I always forget. But there was a mural in the back of the room, and it was Towns, Guy, Jerry Jeff, a guy, Don Sanders, who's a local folk. He was very, you know, big on that scene, and Mickey Newberry. And, you know, when I played there, it was usually pretty empty, so I could see the mural very clearly when I was playing. And it was, so I knew people that knew Guy's songs, and I heard them from other people playing them, from Jerry Jeff recording them. I knew Towns. And then I just decided that to check Nashville out, and even though there was a lot going on in Austin, but it was a little all over the place, to tell you the truth. And what was happening in Nashville seemed way more like people were getting something done. And that's where Guy was, and that's where I settled. And I immediately met Guy within a few nights of getting to town, and I had a sort of automatic introduction because I knew Towns.
Was it like purposeful? You went to see him, or was it... The beauty of life, coincidence.
I was looking for Guy Clark when I went there. I was looking for Towns Van Zandt when I went to Houston. I was looking for Guy Clark when I went to Nashville. You know, Chris Christopherson was already gone, and Guy Clark was who you looked for. A friend of mine named Richard Dobson, who was a songwriter from Texas, really great songwriter. He wrote, you know, Baby Ride Easy, and he was the bartender at a place called Bishop's Pub, and I'd been in town a few weeks and hanging out there. Guy and Susanna had already moved out to this house out in the lake, which eventually Towns lived in. It's where Towns actually passed away, but they were living far enough out that you didn't see them quite as much. And I walked into the joint one night, and Richard says, "Guy's in the back," and there's a pool room in the back of Bishop's. So I went back there, and, you know, I got my hat pulled down low over my eyes and kind of sitting in the corner watching him shoot pool. It was him and Susanna and Jim Stafford and Deborah Allen playing, you know, partners against each
what
other.
What kind of hat were you wearing?
The two couples. Oh, it's a cowboy hat. Nobody would have recognized me without a cowboy hat when I first got to Nashville. I wore one all the time. But I just sat there back and watched him, and he was leaning over a shot, and he looks up and through his eyebrows and sees me and notices me, and he says, "I like your hat." And that began the conversation, and then, you know, he found out I knew Towns, and I was sort of temporarily in until he heard a couple of songs, and then I was in, and I had a teacher.
You said you played bass, so were you a bass player, or did you just
No, kinda... I was the worst bass. No. What happens, Rodney had
been... We're talking
been,
Rodney,
you know,
Crowell, okay?
I'm sorry. Skinny Dennis Sanchez had been sort of everybody's bass player in Nashville, and they had gone back to L.A. by that time. He and Rodney had been roommates. Guy owned... Because he had played some bass. He owned a 65 Precision bass. You know, Rodney played bass with him the few gigs that he played that he didn't do by himself. And, you know, we were getting closer to maybe his first record. It took forever to make his first record. There were lots of fits and starts. And then, you know, after I'd been in town about a year, the record was finally coming out, and he had to have a band. He said Rodney had moved to L.A. to play with Emmy Lou by that time. And so I guess what the kid did was the kid played bass. So I was handed the bass, and I was the kid now because Rodney was gone. So
what was the age difference between you two? You say the kid.
Between me and Guy?
Like, 12, 15?
16 years, something like that, 15, 16 years. I mean, I think Guy was 33 when we met or something like that, and I was, or 34, and I was 19. So it's whatever that is. 14, so it's 14 years, I guess, yeah.
And so what was your attraction to him? I mean, here you are, you leave San Antonio, you leave where you love, your Houston, all that, and head to Nashville. To want to see this, when you heard his songs, what was it about it that made you want to know more about this man?
The stories, you know, it was this thing that I kind of grew up with, and I started writing songs, you know, as soon as I figured out that, you know, I grew up listening to a pretty good mix of country music and pop and folk music, because, you know, I was, you know, Beatles, Stones, Bob Dylan, but I also, the Johnny Cash Show was a big deal in my life, because all of a sudden I didn't feel so weird because I had long hair and cowboy boots, and I lived in a place where the Flying Burrito Brothers were on the radio just by accident, you know, so I always knew who Gram Parsons was when that started. But then this thing started, I started getting out and playing coffee houses, mainly because I was too young to play places that served liquor. And there were still some coffee houses in Texas, and there was a circuit. And you immediately started hearing about Towns Van Zandt, and you started hearing about Guy Clark. And I figured out there was a difference in the way those guys wrote, and that I, for some, my first songs were all girls' names for titles, just like everybody else's, I think. But it was, you know, after a while, I figured out that what came naturally to me was narrative that rhymed and or tried to, and but they were essentially stories, and it was trying to figure out how to tell a story in a song in as little time as possible. I mean, Guy and I, you know, Susanna Clark, his wife, was getting cuts, you know, because she was writing these really compact little country songs. And Guy and I got drunk for a week when the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald went to number one, because we thought maybe there was some hope for us, because we were writing all these, you know, epics. And
just real quick for frame reference, because that song is, it's a Gordon Lightfoot song, is like 6+ minutes. It was on the radio all the time about a ship,
like,
you know,
and they played it
over and over again.
They played
it. So that was
it.
An inspiration to you, right? There was hope.
Yeah, and the coolest thing was it was a contemporary event. It wasn't something that happened 100 right. years ago. It just happened like 2 years before when he wrote the song. So it's one of those things. We were folk singers. We were, you know, we wrote stuff that you had to go to the library and research before the internet existed. And Ben McCullough was a day in the library for me, which I wrote when I was 20 years old. And Guy, just for some reason, saw in me, I think probably the same way I do some younger writers I run into, some of him. And him and Towns were totally different. It's like the difference between different. Towns would give me a copy of "Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee" and tell me go read it. Guy would show me how he laid a song out on the page. You know, and they were. It's like the difference between Kerouac and Ginsberg. You know, like Kerouac died young, didn't write the last, you know, decade and a half of his life. The same thing with Towns. Towns only lived to be 51, and he didn't. He wrote a couple of songs. They were both great songs, but he only wrote a couple of songs in the last 15 years of his life. But Guy worked every day. Wrote songs right up until just a few months before he passed away.
You said something really interesting that I don't know if you could lay out for people, but when you said that Guy was the kind of person who would lay out the pattern or the thread of a story on a page, are you talking like diagrams? Well, first this has happened, then we go down here and that happened. What describe what you mean
by
that?
Yeah, basically, what he showed me was what he did. And he wrote on yellow legal pads he'd always say with a pencil and a big eraser. And he'd write whatever the inspiration was, whether it was a chorus or a verse. And if he knew it was a chorus, he'd put it in down the page. And then he would leave space if he already had the melody, he would draw out lines and number them where the lines go in and start filling in the gaps. And that, you know, so I started doing that. Now, the problem I had was my handwriting was so illegible that even when I was sober, I would often wake up and have written something down and could not read my own handwriting. So digital saved me. And I basically write the way that Guy Clark taught me to write, except I do it on an iPhone. I you know, anything I put in notes on my phone goes on my computer or my iPad automatically. And the cool thing about computers, and I teach this because I teach songwriting, in this camp that I do, I you know, in digital, you can lay it out on the page, and if you go, oh, that's not really the first verse, that's the second verse, you can grab the whole verse and drag it down the page. So it works great for songwriting the way that I was taught to do it. He was methodical. He would, no doubt about it. He built guitars, you know, and I once asked him, why do you always build two guitars? And this is a stupid question to me now, because I know a lot about, I collect guitars and I know a lot about building them. But this was when I was 20. I asked him why they always built at least two. They're always built in batches of even numbers. And there's a reason, he looked at me like, you know, a little surprised that I couldn't figure it out logically. He said, because there's always glue drying. You know, so you start two guitars, and while the glue's drying on one procedure, you go to the next and do the next procedure on the other guitar. That's the way he was. It wasn't an assembly line. It was pure inspiration, but the idea was to keep it organized so inspiration did not get away from you.
Do you ever write two songs at once?
I have, yeah. I'm writing for theater. It's the reason I moved to New York in the first place, and I'm writing a piece for the same couple, Jessica Blank and Eric Jensen, who wrote The Exonerated. They have a piece that's yet untitled. It's about Upper Big Branch, that long wall mine that blew up in West Virginia 9 years ago. And I'm writing songs for that. And those songs will be the core of my next record after the Guy record, which I've got now, thanks to being able to put the Guy record, it's going to come out in 2020. And it's the more political record that I promised. Wow.
Talk about Dublin Blues for a minute. It's a song, you know, not unfamiliar. It's someone in love with someone else, and then they leave them, and there are two feelings that go on in people's brains. One is, I want you back, and the other is, I'm really happy when I can't think about you anymore. Just right.
Well, I mean, it's tough for us that knew. We all, I think I got married as many as times as I did. I was trying to, you know, like recreate two things, my parents and Guy and Susanna. And they were together, you know, till Susanna died. It wasn't linear and it wasn't perfect. They were separated for a while. Dublin Blues, I guess, is about that period. It's a later song, you know, by my standards. Most of the stuff on this album is older stuff. And so some people, I didn't record the Cape. I didn't record a lot of stuff on the later records. Some stuff I did, but I was more connected to earlier stuff. So it's heavily weighted towards earlier stuff. And it's already 16 songs. It's an incredible body of work that this man left. It's a lot of great songs. But this song, you know, it's tough because it's a little personal. And it's a little, if you don't know them, you relate it to your life, and that's the mark of a great song. It's tougher for us that knew them. You understand what I'm saying? Because we kind of, I have trouble believing it's about me. I know it's about Guy and Susanna.
There's a beauty in the way this song works, and I'm trying to, by using one song, trying to get into the songwriting genius that you find that attracts you to him. One thing that you said, and I find true too, is when a song becomes universal, it's true to the writer, but to the listener, you can take away what you need and what you want out of a song.
That's the job. The job's empathy. People don't care about what happens to you. They care about what happens to you that they can relate to. I learned that a long time ago. I think that when I was doing it because Guy did it, but he never told me that I needed to do it, and Towns never told me they needed to do it. They just did it. But when I was playing a benefit with Johnny Cash and John D. Loudermilk and Waylon Jennings, and a bunch of people were there, and we were sitting around talking, and Cash said, I like that song of yours, Little Rock and Roller. And I was just, you know, Johnny Cash said he liked one of my songs. So I was, you know, after walking around about 4 or 5 feet off the ground for several days, I got back on a bus. And a few weeks later, I'm in a truck stop somewhere, and a truck driver walked up to me and said, man, I like that song of yours, Little Rock and Roller, and the light went on. They both related to the song, but they both related to it because they both traveled for a living and they both have kids. That's nobody.
And there's big diesels
nobody
and
cares.
Truck stops and things that.
Yeah, nobody cares that you're feeling sorry for yourself because you're riding around on a bus that costs more than their house. It's the stuff that you have in common. It's the stuff that makes everybody hurt that an audience is going to respond to.
Do you have people coming up to you who are your Guy Clark, to, you know, the way you were?
I don't know that it's as intense as it was, because for one thing, we were all part of a salon that existed for a brief period of time in Nashville. I just happened to get there. The inmates were in charge of the asylum when I got there, and that window closed very quickly. And I was maybe the last person that arrived and benefited from him. Rodney and I are kind of the same class. And, you know, Rodney and I have a lot in common. We discovered recently we were both at the same Beatles concert in 1965.
Where was that?
Houston, the afternoon show at the Houston Coliseum. I was 10, and he was like 13 or 14.
But you may have even walked by shows, one another, right? I mean, that's the possibility.
Well, we may have been. He was sitting in pretty good seats, I understood. I was up. It didn't matter. You couldn't hear anyway. I'm very thankful that I'm able to make a living doing this, number one. And number two, I'm very thankful that I came along at a time, this period when Bob Dylan had sort of single-handedly elevated pop music to an art form by the force of lyrics. I really truly believe that this moment when Bob Dylan wants to be John Lennon and John Lennon wants to be Bob Dylan makes rock and roll art overnight. And otherwise, it's just songs about cars and girls. And I grew up with that music. That's the music, you know, I didn't know that there was any. And Bob Dylan was on the Johnny Cash show, and so was Merle Haggard. And I grew up in Texas, and I grew up with a lot of danceable country music, too, you know, because everybody that I saw in country bands in San Antonio had been in Ray Price's band at one time or another, including Johnny Bush and Daryl McCall and Willie Nelson. So,
talked about when Dylan and Cash met, that in rock and roll, those worlds didn't meet much until then.
right?
No, I don't believe they did. I mean, look, I got into this kind of war with Peter Guralnick, kind of a quiet war on a panel we were on together once, because he doesn't seem to think Bob Dylan's that big of a deal. And his argument is that Robert Johnson was as good as Bob Dylan, you know, and other people. You know, it's Robert Johnson, it is about the songs. Trust me, there were guitar players that were as good as Robert Johnson was. Whatever he went to the Crossroads and sold his soul for, you know, Skip James must have showed up right behind him. There were other guitar players that were just as good. But he wrote every single song that the modern blues is based on. And he wrote them. As far as we know, there are no earlier versions. It's pretty original. It's kind of like bluegrass. You know, Bill Monroe single-handedly invented something. Well, Robert Johnson did too. But he was a natural. He did it. And he was just trying to make pop records. That's what people don't get about it. He was just trying. He played dances, and he was playing to entertain people and to pick up girls. Cole Porter, the same thing. This was a guy that could have been a professor, could have been writing novels, could have been writing poetry, but he decided to write pop music, and he applied this really high degree of literary skill. But he was slumming, you know. Bob did it on purpose. Bob, you know, he wasn't the only person in the village that figured out they could write their own folk songs rather than play 100-year-old songs. Paxton figured it out the same time. A few other people did. But Bob was better than everybody else. And he was a sponge. He read all the right stuff. He listened to all the right records, stole them if he had to. And he knew he was Bob Dylan.
Do you think of Bob Dylan's songs as songs of empathy? Like, I find them more imagery. I'm not sure that I empathize with, like, a Rolling Stone. They're so convoluted. There are moments where I feel an emotion, but they're not the character songs for the most part. I mean, Ballad of Thin Man.
They are. They're just, I believe they are. They're just for a moment. Look, I'm once trying to pick up girls with, you know, that were wearing, you know, Wranglers and boots and a lot of turquoise when I started doing this. And Bob was trying to pick up girls with black turtlenecks, you know, in the village. It was, you impressed the people he was around with imagery that hearkened to French poets, for instance. That, like, the difference between Towns and Bob, more than anything else, is influences. Towns was listening to really conventional lyric poets. He was into Robert Frost and Shakespeare, and Bob was into, you know, French poets and the Beats. So it seems convoluted to some people, but the more you listen to it, the more is there. And all he was doing was flexing his muscles. And then all of a sudden, you know, he writes, "Tonight I'll be staying here with you," or he writes, "Just like a woman." You know, he writes, it's the same thing. It's the same job. he just had chops that nobody else had, and he was just trying them out.
Did you ever write a song with Guy Clark?
No. So I don't have very many regrets. I know that seems weird, as bad as I've lived my life at some points in it. But, you know, some where my children are concerned. But for the most part, my biggest regret, I think, when I die, is going to be Guy actually said, about 2 years before he passed away, "We need to write a song just for the grandkids, if nothing else." And I was living in New York by then, and I saw him as much as I could, but I didn't see him enough, and we never did it. And that's one of the few things I'll carry to my grave. Mm.
Thanks for your time today. Really appreciate it. Okay. I really appreciate this. I think this will turn a lot of people onto music that they've heard before, or maybe not heard before, and
maybe not. Yeah, no. And that's the reason. And the other reason for doing it is it helps me. It helps me remember, you know, like, where I come from and how do I move on from here? Because I want to be like him. I want to do this right up until I'm gone.
That's beautiful. Well, don't go anytime soon. Stay on that bus.
Trying my best. Yeah, my
thank you so much. Steve Earle, his new album by Steve Earle and the Dukes is called Guy. It's a tribute to Guy Clark. I'm Bob Boylan for NPR Music. Let's hear all of Dublin Blues right now.
I wish I was in Austin.
It's All Songs Considered.
In the chilly parlor bar, drinking Mad Dog margaritas, and not caring where you are. Here I sit in Dublin, just rolling cigarettes and holding back. acting, choking back to shits with every breath. So forgive me all my anger, forgive me all my faults. Ain't no need to forgive me for thinking what I thought. I loved you from the get-go, I love you till I die. I'm just a poor boy, what's my middle name? If money was a reason, then I would not be the same. I'll stand up and be counted, I'll face up to the truth. I'll walk away from trouble, but I can't walk away from you. Forgive me all my anger, give me all my faults. Ain't no need to forgive me for thinking what I thought. I love you from the get-go, I love you till I die. I love you on the spinning steps till you say goodbye. Margaritas and not care.